Hi, I'm Nikki Sweat, producer of Music at Menlo's Audio Notes. Here, I'll be talking about the second concert of the Menlo season, to be given on Sunday, July 17th. The concert's titled Wind Variations, and on it you'll hear the contrasting voices of different wind instruments and different eras, divertimentos and serenades by Joseph Haydn, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, and Ludwig van Beethoven, a mischievous tarantelle for flute and clarinet by Camille Saint-Saëns, and at the heart of it, Béla Bartók's striking and original work for clarinet, violin, and piano, appropriately named Contrasts. I spoke with the bassoonist Peter Kolke, who told me a bit about the history of wind compositions, and he introduced me to the first number on the program, a divertimento in D for six winds that Joseph Haydn wrote in the late 1750s or early 1760s.
Wind players in the 18th century were often employed in courts, in larger households, as military musicians, or they would possibly be liveried servants that would also play an instrument on the side. And you can imagine being a footman and a clarinet player, or being a soldier and an oboist. So you were sort of a combination of things. And that's how wind players made their living. And the music that they were playing was often meant for outdoor use. It was sort of incidental music. A lot of the music written at the time was called Feldmusik or field music, music to be done outside in the field. So it was entertainment. It wasn't really meant to be savored over as much as it was to be accompanimental to whatever outdoor activities were going on, whether it was a military display of strength or whether it was a hunt or whether it was a garden party. So that's how wind players were keeping themselves employed. So we have this instrumental scheme, which is holding the piece together. And then we have a series of very small movements. And Haydn was only early in his career. He wasn't even 30 yet when he wrote these things. And they're actually quite experimental in many ways. You can hear Haydn trying out new things that maybe he couldn't have gotten away with in a symphony or a string quartet, where it would have been music that was paid slightly more attention to. This is probably music to be out in the Esterházy court. You know, military musicians are out playing it. So Haydn had the opportunity to play around with some textures and some timbres and some musical ideas that may not have gotten appreciated in a different setting. So it's actually quite exciting. As small as the movements are, they really pack a lot of information into tiny little pieces of music. So in the first movement of the Haydn Divertimento, I love the fact that the first phrase is five measures. Classical era pieces, Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, they often break down into groups of four measures or multiples of four. And Haydn, of course, from the first measure, it's a five-bar phrase, which I think is really exciting and really fantastic. So what you have is the oboes with the melody. You have the horns sort of filling in the inner part. And then you have the bassoons doing a really active bass line. They're sort of bouncing all over the place. You play your first movement, which is the longest movement of the piece. And even then, it's only about 3 minutes long. And then you have this tiny little miniature encore. I also pictured this group of six musicians sort of at a garden party. Maybe it's because we're also used to pandemic eating outdoors and tables sort of spread out. I pictured the six musicians playing their movement at one table, and then to get from one table to the next, they have like this little travel music that takes about 20 seconds to play. And that's this little scherzo, which is really, really cute. It's not substantial in its melodic material at all. But I can just see this group of six musicians walking from one table to the next, and then they're going to play the next movement at the next table. So everybody gets something slightly different than they can, that they can talk about later after dessert. The third movement of this piece is a minuet, and minuets and their subsequent outgrowth, which was scherzos, could be very experimental. And in this third movement minuet, we do have a very typical, beautiful oboe line to start the movement. The second half of the minuet itself becomes very contrapuntal in spots. We only have two lines. It becomes almost severe for about four bars. And you can hear Haydn doing his little counterpoint exercise, perhaps, in a four-bar phrase in the second half. And then you jump to the trio. And the trio is completely different than the minuet because the trio explores the key of D minor. The bassoons play a really almost baroque-like chromatic line, which ascends and descends through these little scallops of chromatic pitches. What I think is experimental about this trio is the fact that there's almost no real melodic material. It's just sort of D minor. We have this weird bassoon line followed by cadential formula. It's almost like Haydn is saying, we don't need a melody. I'm just going to explore this really interesting color and this really strange choice of notes. And that's enough to build a section of music around. In this adagio movement, in the fourth movement of Haydn, again, we get lots of dynamic contrasts that almost become as important as the melodic and the harmonic material. So the very first chord is just a D major chord, and Haydn writes a crescendo. There's nothing else going on. It's just a simple chord, but that crescendo becomes motivic. And so we begin to hear this crescendo again and again and again. And so we have this crescendo, we go back to soft. We have a forte. And then after a three-bar phrase, which is also very unique, we have another sort of restarting of a crescendo. So we begin to realize that Haydn is going to play with dynamics in this movement. And that's what we are supposed to listen for. The second minuet in the Haydn Divertimento, again, we have a sort of a reiteration of D major. We have a very dance-like theme. It's a little bit lighter, a little bit more active than the first minuet. Of greatest interest in this movement is actually the trio, where the horns sit out and we just have the two oboes and the bassoons, and we go to G major. It's the first time we've gotten G major at all in the piece. A new key, we have a new texture, new color because no horns. And this harkens back to almost Baroque idea of the trio. And you think about the Bach Brandenburg First Concerto, where this sequence of minuets, that's the last movement, the very first trios for two oboes and bassoon. And here we have in Haydn a trio for two oboes and two bassoons, yes, but they mostly play the same thing all the time. The few times that they don't play the same thing in the bassoon part, they actually come to the fore. They all of a sudden, there's nothing going on but two bassoons just for a second. And it's the only time in the piece that we get something like that. So as a bassoonist myself, I look very forward to playing those little passages because Haydn was showing off that, yes, the bassoons can be melodic as well. I thought of this last movement, which again is probably 30 seconds long, as being an encore. Here we are, we're going to finish this out on an upward note. We're going to let you eat your next course, and we're going to be back in a few minutes with the new divertimento in perhaps G major or A major.
On this program, though, the next number will remain in the celebratory key of D. Throughout the 1790s, Ludwig van Beethoven was building his reputation and his repertoire as a composer. He published solo piano music and chamber works, like his first piano trios and cello sonatas, but he also worked on occasional pieces for civic dances, events, and private patrons. His Serenade for the creative combination of flute, violin, and viola, written during that time and eventually published in 1802 as his Opus 25, is a work that straddles concert performance styles and this less formal approach to composition, and it wound up being one of his major commercial hits. Flutist Soo-Yun Kim told me more about the piece and why it was and is so popular.
You can hear the very young and curious and juvenile Beethoven in the Opus 25 Serenade. I think you hear him kind of experimenting with different ideas, different timbres of different instruments, and yet with a very cheerful and young, upbeat music. One of the advantages of the three instruments is that we can be extremely light and fleet, and it's really fast, but he kind of really understood the abilities of these three instruments and then three instruments combined to create music that sounds like, I almost feel like I'm on a tippy toe on a hot plate when I play this. There isn't a single moment where it feels like something is grounded and settling. It's just on its feet and then just flitting through. And I think that's kind of the effect that you could only get from the three instruments, flute, violin, and the viola. So the flute comes in and makes a grand entrance, or it could be a very cute entrance, depending on what you think of this first phrase, and it gets answered by the violin and the viola. And it's really fun, and then you immediately hear the interactions between the three instruments, sometimes together. It's like duo versus a solo, or it could be three combined together, or sometimes it's three individual voices doing its own thing, but just at the same time. The second movement, you know, it's titled minuet, like a dance. Mm-hmm. to me, it's like Beethoven is giving an opportunity for each instrument to take the floor. The first trio is basically like pas de deux between violin and the viola. They do their own beautiful dance. And then the flute takes the center stage in the second trio and gets to do all kinds of acrobatic stuff and really show off the virtuosity. Third movement, it's actually one of my favorite to play. It's a movement that gets me really excited, and it's like really high energy. It's like playing a game. Every move you make, you have to know exactly where to put it. And then you also have to know exactly where the players that you're playing with are going to put the next move too. Because that's kind of the only way to stay on top of this movement. The variation movement, especially in the theme, it's like a song. It's I would say the first moment where Beethoven gives the instruments the opportunity to really be a singer, very vocal. The variations, though, it becomes clearer for me that he is a piano keyboard player, kind of like Beethoven as a pianist. If he had an option of kind of coloring different voices with different instruments, I think these are the instruments that he would actually assign a particular lines to. And you can almost hear someone playing one line with the left hand and one line with the right hand. But in this case, it's divided into two different instruments. The fifth movement is, this one's really like a game of maybe tail catching. We're just kind of like trying to get behind each other. One voice jump starts a phrase a beat early. And then it's like, yeah, the next instrument kind of enters it thinking, oh, are you going already? You know. The adagio, I could hear Beethoven wanting to do something pastoral. The three instruments, the flute, violin, and viola, becomes something that could sound like a horn, and then kind of a little bit like a bagpipe too. It it's an instrument that does not exist in this world, obviously, but the sound, the only sound that could be created by the flute, violin, and viola when we're really in sync with each other. And when that happens, it's really magical. Then it bounces really quickly into the finale. And the finale, it's in two, and it makes me want to dance. If we can make everyone get up and dance towards the end of this movement, I would say that's a pretty successful performance.
The second half of the concert starts with something quite different. A 1938 trio for clarinet, violin, and piano, written by the Hungarian modernist Béla Bartók. He wrote it for the American jazz clarinetist Benny Goodman and the Hungarian violinist Joseph Zsigedy. And in it, we hear references to Hungarian folk music, hints of American popular music, some extraordinary technical innovations for the featured instruments, and, as one would expect given the title, numerous contrasts. Clarinetist Tommaso Longquich explains how Bartók constructed each of the work's three movements.
So the first movement of the piece is called the Ferbunkos. That's a traditional Hungarian dance. And it is actually a recruiting dance. It is a military recruiting dance, which was used during the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Basically, the officers and the troops, they would go around the country and they would really perform this dance where there would be normally about a dozen soldiers. And the dance is characterized itself by contrasts because the dance alternates traditionally dotted rhythms, pam, pa-pam, pa-pam. With sudden virtuosic runs. In both larger sections, but also in individual phrases. In the dance itself, it is kind of going by age group and by rank. So the first, the slower, more majestic dotted rhythm, that's normally opened and danced by the leading sergeant. And then the lower officers are joining into the dance, dancing the more energetic parts. And finally, the youngest soldiers, you know, the ones who are most fit to jump around, they are kind of ending with a big virtuosic dance and spur clicking and all kinds of things. So that is in itself a dance which contains contrasts. The second movement of the Bartók contrasts is starkly different to the opening and to the third movement. It is really more restful. It is a kind of meditation, and it is titled in that way, but not in the way that we imagine today. I think today we have a very different idea of meditation than what Bartók had back then. Now, you know, it's the 21st century and we've gone through transcendental meditation and we know more about Buddhism and Zen. And I think we're used to thinking of meditation as in a more new age way, let's say, as something very pleasant, very relaxing. That's not how this music feels to me anyway. It is slow, that is true. It has a very slow tempo, and it is the writing is sparse. There are not many major events in this movement that are strong and extroverted, but it is not peaceful, I would say, because the harmonies and the writing has within it contrast as well. The most obvious and apparent, I would say, contrasts in the piece is the fact that Bartok requires two instruments for the clarinetist and two instruments for the violinists. The first movement is for A clarinet, the second movement is for A clarinet, then the third movement starts for B clarinet, which is a little more brilliant, slightly more brilliant, as is the music that begins the third movement. Then in the middle section of the third movement, which is a kind of slow dance-like section, a darker section in the low register, he has the clarinetist go back to the A clarinet. So he wants it again a darker, more velvety, more subdued tone. And then very quickly, as this B section ends and we go back to the virtuosic fireworks of the faster tempo, he wants the clarinetist to switch back to B flat clarinet. The violinist also, this is even more rare, the violinist is switching instruments, and this is quite unheard of. I mean, it happens in is it Mahler fourth? There is a scordatura violin, but generally speaking, a violinist plays their violin and that's it. Here we have a violin for the beginning of the third movement, which is tuned with scordatura. That is, it's tuned in a way that is not the traditional tuning. And it makes immediately for a very folk sound, because you have open fifths, and so it's a very typically folk sound, not very refined. Quite rough and beautiful because of that.
Another trio will follow Bartok and lighten the mood, a delightful palate cleanser in the form of a tarantelle for flute, clarinet, and piano, written in 1857 by Camille Saint-Saëns. He was a young man of 22 when he composed this, his Opus 6, unafraid to push the musicians he was writing for to their technical limits, and to display his magnificent musical sense of humor as well. Soo-Yun Kim told me about the origins of this piece in an Italian dance form, and about what makes this particular tarantelle so funny.
It's very goofy. I kind of sometimes imagine an Italian grandpa walking down the street, you know? And he's just kind of like strolling around and looking around. You know, it goes dun 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 dun, and then goes da, there I am. Oh, he saw someone that he knows, I don't know. And he says, hello, or buongiorno. Tarantelle is actually a French translation of tarantella, which is an Italian dance. It's a dance that usually involves instruments like tambourine, accordion. If you Google or look it up on YouTube, you're going to see a lot of videos of people dancing tarantella at their weddings. So sometimes it's danced around a circle, sometimes they are in a row, but it's kind of like a communal dance, and it's danced usually as a part of a celebration. it's really fast, and it's either in cut time in two or in four, and each speed is subdivided into three. So there are triplets, four triplets going around, and that is the bass rhythm for tarantella. Tarantella in Italian form sounds very rustic. And the Saint-Saëns tarantelle is actually very, almost too elegant compared to the original Italian version. Kind of funny sometimes you see composers taking their own interpretation of what is meant to be a very nationalistic or iconic dance by different countries. So in this case, Saint-Saëns, he titles it tarantelle in French, but it's actually influenced by an Italian tarantella. First entrance of the flute and the clarinet were playing this exact same thing, and something really bubbly and almost like caricature-like. It's two very different looking characters trying to do the same thing together. When the flute and the clarinet are kind of in each other's sound, then you get a sound that's completely different than when we're individual.
In October 1781, at 11 o'clock at night, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was nearly in his dressing gown when suddenly he was called to the window. As he remembered in a letter to his father, "I was serenaded by two clarinets, two horns, and two bassoons playing my own music. The six gentlemen who executed it are poor beggars who together play quite nicely all the same. These musicians had the front gate opened for them, and when they had formed up in the yard, they gave me, just as I was about to undress for bed, the most delightful surprise in the world with that opening E-flat chord." Mozart had written this sextet for the name day of a useful acquaintance, and went on to revise it into a wind serenade for clarinets, oboes, horns, and bassoons, his great serenade in E-flat major, K375. It was a means of displaying the vocal and operatic qualities of wind instruments that Mozart discovered and explored with great energy during this period, and it is a perfect close to this concert of chamber music for winds. Peter Kolke told me more about the serenade, and about what had changed in wind writing from the time when Haydn composed that divertimento that started off the concert program.
About 20 years separate the Haydn work and the Mozart serenade, and the instrumentation had changed over time. So you had to have your two horns. You had to have your bassoon line, usually covered by two bassoons. In Haydn's case, the court he was at had two oboists. Mozart wrote this piece originally for two clarinets, two bassoons, and two horns. It was a sextet. So the instrumentation for these things were not fixed. There were some courts that had English horns. You may have a other bass instruments thrown in there. You may have a flute here and there, but you wrote for the instruments that you had available to you. So originally Mozart had written this for a sextet with clarinets. And later in 1782, what happened was Emperor Josef in Vienna appointed a wind octet to his court, two oboes, two clarinets, two bassoons, and two horns. And that became the standard instrumentation. This became the military music, servants playing it, dinner music. And then by 1780s, it was indoor music to be listened to, perhaps, or for more courtly dinners inside. So a higher standard of repertoire was called for. The opening of this wind serenade, it's famous amongst wind players because Mozart writes these first chords of E flat, and each one has its own little unique dynamic and articulation mark. And we have to figure out what he meant by all that. We just don't know. We have these chords and they sort of get faster and faster. And you think, what's going to happen, right? It's sort of setting the scene for like, oh, there's going to be intrigue. There's going to be, you know, someone is going to dress up as someone else and assume a false identity. You just hear the operatic, the comic opera about to happen. And then what he does is we end up getting a lot of long notes. And you wouldn't think of a fast opening movement as having sort of this expanse of almost static chords going on with very small little melodic interjections, but he's building the tension, he's building the drama, and then all of a sudden we erupt. Into sort of this joyous passage with running notes and lots of rhythmic energy. Yeah, just in the first 30 seconds of the piece, he really packs a wallop. So in the second movement, Minuet, it's more substantial than Haydn's. It's more developmental. We have a little bit more going on. He spends a little bit more time within the form, showing off his skills, developing the melodic material. We also have a interesting trio, which does touch on the minor mode and gives a more of a role to the horns. So the horns generally don't get a lot of melodic material in this stuff. They weren't used for their melodic abilities. They were used to sort of fill out the harmony and give it that outdoor sound. But here, Mozart liberates the horns and allows them to lead the argument. And there's one really small passage. It just lasts four bars, but it's probably my favorite four bars in the piece, where we have the two horns and just the second bassoon playing. And they just had this 4-bar passage, which looks forwards and backwards at the same time. It shows off the color of the instruments. It says, hey, you know, this is the color that's always been there. I'm going to reveal it for you for just 4 measures. And then we're going to go back to all this wonderful texture with these upper instruments. It's a game that I often play with my students. If this were in an opera, what would they be singing? Who would they be singing to? I hear the aria that happens by the lead character at the end of the opera after he or she has taken off the mask or the false identity or the costume, and they're singing to their beloved, it was me you loved all along, all this intrigue was for some other purpose, and I realize now how ridiculous it all was, and I hope you'll forgive me, and I still love you, and I know you still love me. So it's an aria of revelation, a little bit of confession, but also a little bit of reconciliation that makes it sound a bit heavier than it really is, but it's filled with this relief and joy and purity that only Mozart can capture, it seems, in his operas. So the first minuet is very chordal in its nature. So the tune just arpeggiates a chord. The second minuet has a little bit different melodic material where it's more rhythmic based. And we begin to lose where the downbeat is. And then in the trio of this movement, we actually get to a new key. We explore A flat major. So again, trios were a good place to explore new keys. And this one is a musette. And a musette is basically a sort of gentle dance-like movement over a bass. So you have one of the bassoons just basically pumping out an A flat for most of the trio. And so it has this rustic quality. So it's a very identifiable dance type. The last movement is so much fun to play. It's so much fun to listen to. You just have to appreciate Mozart's genius here, where he has a melody which is based around a single note being repeated. Well, that's not the most interesting melody in the world, but the bass line is descending chromatically in spots. So you have this really stable melody and this really kind of unstable, surging, searching bass line at the same time. So you have these, you know, almost two characters. One is like, hey, we're going to be fine. The other one's like, no, you know, I'm still crazed and I'm looking for whatever it is I've lost. Then he begins to play with these instrumental textures so that the instrumentation and the textures are changing every couple of bars. And when he went and changed from the sextet to the octet version, for most of it, he rewrote the clarinet parts and divvied them up between the clarinets and the oboes. This movement, he actually will double them sometimes. So you get this really unique color where the oboe and the clarinet are in unison, And it's not anything we've heard. And it has this tanginess to it that is just so joyous, that it's such a unique sound that we don't often get in this style of music. You think of eight characters on the stage. They each have something to say. Sometimes they're saying it just to each other. They're partners in crime, if you will. Sometimes they're saying it across the stage. Sometimes they're agreeing, sometimes they're not. But at the end, they're all gonna find closure on their E-flat major chord, however they come to it.
Music at Menlo audio notes are written and produced by myself, Nikki Sweat, in consultation with David Finkel and Wu Han. Many thanks to Peter Kolke, Suyun Kim, and Tommaso Longquich for speaking with me on this session. Musical excerpts appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations: Haydn's Divertimento in D major, HOB 2 D18, performed by Haydn Ensemble Berlin, appears on the Campanella Musica Solo Musica label. Beethoven's Serenade in D Major for Flute, Violin, and Viola, Opus 25, was played by Tara Helen O'Connor, Aaron Boyd, and Paul Neubauer. Bartok's Contrasts for Violin, Clarinet, and Piano was played by Anthony McGill, Georgia Flizanis, and Derek Hahn, and can be heard on the Music at Menlo Live label. The Tarantelle in A Minor for Flute, Clarinet, and Piano, Opus 6 by Camille Saint-Saëns, was performed by Suyun Kim, Romy de Guise Langlois, and Gilbert Kalish. And Mozart's Serenade in E-flat Major for Winds, K375, was performed by Stephen Taylor, James Austin Smith, David Schifrin, Romy de Guise Langlois, Bram van Sambeek, Peter Kolke, Radovan Vlatkovic, and Trevor Knuckles. Audio notes are a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.